with Kuta Tanda, translated by Bhikkhu Sujato. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was wandering in the land of the Magadans together with a large sangha of around 500 mendicants when he arrived at a village of the Magadan Brahmins named Kanumata. There he stayed nearby at Ambalatika. Now at that time the Brahmin Kutadanda was living in Kanumata. It was a crown property given by King Saniya Bimbisara of Magadha, teeming with living creatures, full of hay, wood, water and grain, a royal endowment of the highest quality. Now at that time Kutadanda had prepared a great sacrifice. Bulls, bullocks, heifers, goats and rams, 700 of each, had been led to the post for the sacrifice. The Brahmins and householders of Kanumata heard, "It seems the ascetic Gotama, a Sakyan gone forth from a Sakyan family, has arrived at Kanumataka and is staying in a forest nearby. He has this good reputation. That blessed one is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He has realized with his own insight this world, with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans, and he makes it known to others. He teaches Dhamma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, meaningful and well-phrased. And he reveals a spiritual practice that's entirely full and pure. It's good to see such perfected ones." Then, having departed Kanumata, they formed into companies and headed to Ambalatika. Now at that time the Brahmin Kutadanda had retired to the upper floor of his stilt longhouse for his midday nap. He saw the Brahmins and householders heading for Ambalatika and addressed his steward, "My steward, why are the Brahmins and householders headed for Ambalatika?" "The ascetic Gotama has arrived at Kanumata and is staying at Ambalatika. He has this good reputation. That blessed one is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. They're going to see that Master Gotama." Then Kutadanta thought, "I've heard that the ascetic Gotama knows how to accomplish the sacrifice with 3 modes and 16 accessories. I don't know about that, but I wish to perform a great sacrifice. Why don't I ask him how to accomplish the sacrifice with 3 modes and 16 accessories? Then Kutadanta addressed his steward, "Well then, go to the Brahmins and householders and say to them, 'Sirs, the Brahmin Kutadanta asks you to wait, as he will also go to see the ascetic Gotama.' 'Yes, sir,' replied the steward, and did as he was asked. Now at that time, several hundred Brahmins were residing in Kanumata, thinking to participate in Kutadanta's sacrifice. They heard that Kutadanta was going to see the ascetic Gotama. They approached Kutadanta and said to him, 'Is it really true that you are going to see the ascetic Gotama?' 'Yes, gentlemen, it is true.' 'Please don't. It's not appropriate for you to go to see the ascetic Gotama. For if you do so, your reputation will diminish and his will increase. For this reason, it's not appropriate for you to go to see the ascetic Gotama. It's appropriate that he comes to see you. You are well born on both your mother's and father's side, of pure descent, irrefutable and impeccable in questions of ancestry back to the 7th paternal generation. For this reason, it's not appropriate for you to go to see the ascetic Gotama. It's appropriate that he comes to see you. You're rich, affluent and wealthy, with lots of property and assets, and lots of money and grain. You recite and remember the hymns, and have mastered the 3 Vedas, together with their vocabularies, ritual, phonology and etymology, and the testament as fifth. You know philology and grammar, and are well versed in cosmology and the marks of a great man. You are attractive, good-looking, lovely, of surpassing beauty. You are magnificent, splendid, remarkable to behold. You are ethical, mature in ethical conduct. You're a good speaker with a polished, clear and articulate voice that expresses the meaning. You teach the teachers of many, and teach 300 students to recite the hymns. Many students come from various districts and countries for the sake of the hymns, wishing to learn the hymns. You're old, elderly and senior, advanced in years, and have reached the final stage of life. The ascetic Gotama is young and has newly gone forth. You're honoured, respected, revered, venerated, and esteemed by King Bimbisara of Magadha and the Brahmin Pokarasati. You live in Kanumata, a crown property given by King Seniya Bimbisara of Magadha, teeming with living creatures, full of hay, wood, water and grain, a royal endowment of the highest quality. For this reason it's not appropriate for you to go to see the ascetic Gotama. It's appropriate that he comes to see you. When they had spoken, Kutadanta said to those Brahmins, "Well then, gentlemen, listen to why it's appropriate for me to go to see the ascetic Gotama, and it's not appropriate for him to come to see me. He is well born on both his mother's and father's side, of pure descent, irrefutable and impeccable in questions of ancestry back to the seventh paternal generation. For this reason, it's not appropriate for the ascetic Gotama to come to see me. Rather, it's appropriate for me to go to see him. When he went forth, he abandoned a large family circle. When he went forth, he abandoned abundant gold coin and bullion stored in dungeons and towers. He went forth from the lay life to homelessness while still a youth, young, black-haired, blessed with youth in the prime of life. Though his mother and father wished otherwise, weeping with tearful faces, he shaved off his hair and beard, dressed in ochre robes, and went forth from the lay life to homelessness. He is attractive, good-looking, lovely, of surpassing beauty. He is magnificent, splendid, remarkable to behold. He is ethical, possessing ethical conduct that is noble and skilful. He is a good speaker with a polished, clear and articulate voice that expresses the meaning. He is a teacher of teachers. He has ended sensual desire and is rid of caprice. He teaches the efficacy of deeds and action. He doesn't wish any harm upon the community of Brahmins. He went forth from an eminent family of unbroken aristocratic lineage. He went forth from a rich, affluent and wealthy family. People come from distant lands and distant countries to question him. Many thousands of deities have gone for refuge for life to him. He has this good reputation, that Blessed One is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He has the 32 marks of a great man. He is welcoming, congenial, polite, smiling, open, the first to speak. He's honoured, respected, revered, venerated, and esteemed by the four assemblies. Many gods and humans are devoted to him. While he is residing in a village or town, non-human entities do not harass them. He leads an order and a community and teaches a community and is said to be the best of the various religious founders. He didn't come by his fame in the same ways as those other ascetics and Brahmins. Rather, he came by his fame due to his supreme knowledge and conduct. King Seniya Bimbisara of Magadha and his wives and children have gone for refuge for life to the ascetic Gotama. King Pasanadi of Kosala and his wives and children have gone for refuge for life to the ascetic Gotama. The Brahmin Pokarasati and his wives and children have gone for refuge for life to the ascetic Gotama. He's honoured, respected, revered, venerated and esteemed by King Bimbisara of Magadha, King Pasanadi of Kosala and the Brahmin Pokarasati. The ascetic Gotama has arrived at Kanumata and is staying at Ambalatika. Any ascetic or Brahmin who comes to stay in our village district is our guest and should be honoured and respected as such. For this reason, too, it's not appropriate for Master Gotama to come to see me, rather, it's appropriate for me to go to see him. This is the extent of Master Gotama's praise that I have learned. But his praises are not confined to this, for the praise of Master Gotama is limitless. When he had spoken, those Brahmins said to him, according to Kutatanta's praises, if Master Gotama were staying within 100 leagues, it would be worthwhile for a faithful gentleman to go to see him, even if they had to carry their own provisions and a shoulder bag. Well then, gentlemen, let's all go to see the ascetic Gotama. Then Kutadanta, together with a large group of Brahmins, went to see the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side. Before sitting down to one side, some of the Brahmins and householders of Kanumata bowed, some exchanged greetings and polite conversation, some held up their joined palms toward the Buddha, some announced their name and clan, while some kept silent. Kutadanta said to the Buddha, Master Gotama, I've heard that you know how to accomplish the sacrifice with 3 modes and 16 accessories. I don't know about that, but I wish to perform a great sacrifice. Please teach me how to accomplish the sacrifice with 3 modes and 16 accessories. Well then, Brahmin, listen and pay close attention. I will speak. Yes, sir, Kutadanta replied. The Buddha said this. Once upon a time, Brahmin, there was a king named Mahavijita. He was rich, affluent and wealthy, with lots of gold and silver, lots of property and assets, lots of money and grain, and a full treasury and storehouses. Then as King Mahavijita was in private retreat, this thought came to his mind. I have achieved human wealth and reign after conquering this vast territory. Why don't I hold a large sacrifice? That will be for my lasting welfare and happiness. Then he summoned the Brahmin high priest and said to him, Just now, Brahmin, as I was in private retreat, this thought came to mind. I have achieved human wealth and reign after conquering this vast territory. Why don't I perform a great sacrifice? That will be for my lasting welfare and happiness. Brahmin, I wish to perform a great sacrifice. Please instruct me. It will be for my lasting welfare and happiness. When he had spoken, the Brahmin high priest said to him, Sir, the king's realm is harried and oppressed. Bandits have been seen raiding villages and towns and cities and infesting the highways. But if the king were to extract more taxes while his realm is thus harried and oppressed, he would not be doing his duty. Now the king might think, I'll eradicate this barbarian obstacle by execution or imprisonment or confiscation or condemnation or banishment. But that's not the right way to eradicate this barbarian obstacle. Those who remain after the killing will return to harass the king's realm. Rather, here is a plan relying on which the barbarian obstacle will be properly uprooted. So let the king provide seed and fodder for those in the realm who work in farming and raising cattle. Let the king provide funding for those who work in trade. Let the king guarantee food and wages for those in government service. Then the people, occupied with their own work, will not harass the realm. The king's revenues will be great. When the country is secured as a sanctuary, free of being harried and oppressed, the happy people, with joy in their hearts, dancing with children at their breast, will dwell as if their houses were wide open. The king agreed with the high priest's advice and followed his recommendation. Then the king summoned the Brahmin high priest and said to him, I have eradicated the barbarian obstacle, and relying on your plan, my revenue is now great. Since the country is secured as a sanctuary, free of being harried and oppressed, The happy people, with joy in their hearts, dancing with children at their breast, dwell as if their houses were wide open. Brahmin, I wish to perform a great sacrifice. Please instruct me. It will be for my lasting welfare and happiness. In that case, let the king announce this throughout the realm to the aristocrat vassals, ministers and counsellors, well-to-do Brahmins and well-off householders, both of town and country. I wish to perform a great sacrifice. Please grant your approval, gentlemen. It will be for my lasting welfare and happiness. The king agreed with the high priest's advice and followed his recommendation, and all of the people who were thus informed responded by saying, May the king perform a sacrifice. It is time for a sacrifice, great king. And so these four consenting factions became accessories to the sacrifice. King Mahavijita possessed 8 factors. He was well born on both his mother's and father's side, of pure descent, irrefutable and impeccable in questions of ancestry back to the 7th paternal generation. He was attractive, good-looking, lovely, of surpassing beauty. He was magnificent, splendid, remarkable to behold. He was rich, affluent and wealthy, with lots of gold and silver, lots of property and assets, lots of money and grain, and a full treasury and storehouses. He was powerful, having an army of 4 divisions that was obedient and carried out instructions. He'd probably prevail over his enemies just with his reputation. He was faithful, generous, a donor, his door always open. He was a wellspring of support, making merit with ascetics and Brahmins, for paupers, vagrants, travellers, and beggars. He was very learned in diverse fields of learning. He understood the meaning of diverse statements, saying, This is what that statement means, that is what this statement means. He was astute, competent, and intelligent, able to think issues through as they bear upon the past, future, and present. These are the 8 factors that King Mahavijita possessed. And so these 8 factors also became accessories to the sacrifice. And the Brahmin high priest had 4 factors. He was well born on both his mother's and father's side, of pure descent, irrefutable and impeccable in questions of ancestry, back to the 7th paternal generation. He recited and remembered the hymns and had mastered the 3 Vedas, together with their vocabularies, ritual, phonology and etymology, and the testament as 5th. He knew philology and grammar, and was well versed in cosmology and the marks of a great man. He was ethical, mature in ethical conduct. He was astute and clever, being the 1st or 2nd to hold the sacrificial ladle. These are the 4 factors that the Brahmin high priest possessed. And so these 4 factors also became accessories to the sacrifice. Next, before the sacrifice, the Brahmin high priest taught the 3 modes to the king. Now, though the king wants to perform a great sacrifice, he might have certain regrets, thinking, I shall lose a great fortune, or I am losing a great fortune, or I have lost a great fortune. But the king should not harbour such regrets. These are the 3 modes that the Brahmin high priest taught to the king before the sacrifice. Next, before the sacrifice, the Brahmin high priest dispelled the king's regret regarding the recipients in 10 respects. There will come to the sacrifice those who kill living creatures and those who refrain from killing living creatures. As to those who kill living creatures, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from killing living creatures, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who steal, and those who refrain from stealing. As to those who steal, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from stealing, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who commit sexual misconduct and those who refrain from sexual misconduct. As to those who commit sexual misconduct, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from sexual misconduct, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who lie, and those who refrain from lying. As to those who lie, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from lying, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who use divisive speech, and those who refrain from divisive speech. As to those who use divisive speech, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from divisive speech, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who use harsh speech, and those who refrain from harsh speech. As to those who use harsh speech, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from harsh speech, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who talk nonsense, and those who refrain from talking nonsense. As to those who talk nonsense, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who refrain from talking nonsense, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who are covetous, and those who are not covetous. As to those who are covetous, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who are not covetous, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who have ill will, and those who do not have ill will. As to those who have ill will, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who do not have ill will, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. There will come to the sacrifice those who have wrong view, and those who have right view. As to those who have wrong view, the outcome of that is theirs alone. But as to those who have right view, it is for their sakes that the king should sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. These are the 10 respects in which the high priest dispelled the king's regret regarding the recipients before the sacrifice. Next, while the king was performing the great sacrifice, the Brahmin high priest educated, encouraged, fired up, and inspired the king's mind in 16 respects. Now, while the king is performing the great sacrifice, someone might say, King Mahavijita performs a great sacrifice, but he did not announce it to the aristocrat vassals of town and country. That's the kind of great sacrifice that this king performs. Those who speak against the king in this way have no legitimacy, for the king did indeed announce it to the aristocrat vassals of town and country. Let the king know this as a reason to sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. While the king is performing the great sacrifice, someone might say, King Mahavijita performs a great sacrifice, but he did not announce it to the ministers and councillors, well-to-do Brahmins, and well-off householders, both of town and country. That's the kind of sacrifice that this king performs. Those who speak against the king in this way have no legitimacy, for the king did indeed announce it to all these people. Let the king know this too as a reason to sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. While the king is performing the great sacrifice, someone might say that he does not possess the 8 factors. Those who speak against the king in this way have no legitimacy, for the king does indeed possess the 8 factors. Let the king know this too as a reason to sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. While the king is performing the great sacrifice, someone might say that the high priest does not possess the four factors. Those who speak against the king in this way have no legitimacy. For the high priest does indeed possess the four factors. Let the king know this too as a reason to sacrifice, relinquish, rejoice, and gain confidence in his heart. These are the 16 respects in which the high priest educated, encouraged, fired up, and inspired the king's mind while he was performing the sacrifice. And Brahmin, in that sacrifice, no cattle were killed, no goats were killed, and no chickens or pigs were killed. There was no slaughter of various kinds of creatures, no trees were felled for the sacrificial post, no grass was reaped to strew over the place of sacrifice, no bond servants, employees, or workers did their jobs under threat of punishment and danger, weeping with tearful faces. Those who wished to work did so, while those who did not wish to did not. They did the work they wanted to, and did not do what they didn't want to. The sacrifice was completed with just ghee, oil, butter, curds, honey, and molasses. Then the aristocrat vassals, ministers and counsellors, well-to-do Brahmins and well-off householders of both town and country, came to the king, bringing abundant wealth, and said, "Sire, this abundant wealth is specially for you alone. May your highness accept it. There's enough raised for me through regular taxes. Let this be for you, and here, take even more." When the king turned them down, they withdrew to one side to think up a plan. "It wouldn't be proper for us to take this abundant wealth back to our own homes. King Mahavijita is performing a great sacrifice. Let us make an offering as an auxiliary sacrifice." Then the aristocrat vassals of town and country set up gifts to the east of the sacrificial pit. The ministers and councillors of town and country set up gifts to the south of the sacrificial pit. The well-to-do Brahmins of town and country set up gifts to the west of the sacrificial pit. The well-off householders of town and country set up gifts to the north of the sacrificial pit. And Brahmin, in that sacrifice too, no cattle were killed, no goats were killed, and no chickens or pigs were killed. There was no slaughter of various kinds of creatures, no trees were felled for the sacrificial post, no grass was reaped to strew over the place of sacrifice, no bond servants, employees, or workers did their jobs under threat of punishment and danger, weeping with tearful faces. Those who wished to work did so, while those who did not wish to did not. They did the work they wanted to, and did not do what they didn't want to. The sacrifice was completed with just ghee, oil, butter, curds, honey, and molasses. And so there were four consenting factions, eight factors possessed by King Mahavijita, four factors possessed by the high priest, and three modes. Brahmin, this is called the sacrifice accomplished with three modes and 16 accessories. When he said this, those Brahmins made an uproar. Hooray for such sacrifice! Hooray for the accomplishment of such sacrifice! But the Brahmin Kutadanta sat in silence. So those Brahmins said to him, "How can you not applaud the ascetic Gotama's fine words?" "It's not that I don't applaud what he said. If anyone didn't applaud such fine words, their head would explode. But, gentlemen, it occurs to me that the ascetic Gotama does not say, 'So I have heard,' or 'It ought to be like this.' Rather, he just says, 'So it was then. This is how it was then.' It occurs to me that the ascetic Gotama at that time must have been King Mahavijita, the owner of the sacrifice, or else the Brahmin high priest who facilitated the sacrifice for him. Does Master Gotama recall having performed such a sacrifice or having facilitated it, and then, when his body broke up after death, being reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm?" "I do recall that, Brahmin. for at that time I was the Brahmin high priest who facilitated the sacrifice. But Master Gotama, apart from that sacrifice accomplished with 3 modes and 16 accessories, is there any other sacrifice that has fewer requirements and undertakings, yet is more fruitful and beneficial? There is, Brahmin. But what is it? The regular gifts as ongoing family sacrifice given specially to ethical renunciates. This sacrifice, Brahmin, has fewer requirements and undertakings, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. What is the cause, Master Gotama? What is the reason why those regular gifts as ongoing family sacrifice have fewer requirements and undertakings, yet are more fruitful and beneficial, compared with the sacrifice accomplished with 3 modes and 16 accessories? Because neither perfected ones nor those who have entered the path to perfection will attend such a sacrifice. Why is that? Because beatings and throttlings are seen there. But the regular gifts as ongoing family sacrifice given specially to ethical renunciates, perfected ones and those who have entered the path to perfection will attend such a sacrifice. Why is that? Because no beatings and throttlings are seen there. This is the cause, Brahmin. This is the reason why those regular gifts as ongoing family sacrifice have fewer requirements and undertakings, yet are more fruitful and beneficial, compared with the sacrifice accomplished with 3 modes and 16 accessories. But Master Gotama, apart from that sacrifice accomplished with 3 modes and 16 accessories, and those regular gifts as ongoing family sacrifice, is there any other sacrifice that has fewer requirements and undertakings, yet is more fruitful and beneficial? There is, Brahmin. But what is it? When someone gives a dwelling specially for the Sangha of the 4 quarters. But is there any other sacrifice that has fewer requirements and undertakings, yet is more fruitful and beneficial? When someone with confident heart goes for refuge to the Buddha, the teaching and the Sangha. But is there any other sacrifice that has fewer requirements and undertakings, yet is more fruitful and beneficial? When someone with a confident heart undertakes the training rules to refrain from killing living creatures, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and alcoholic drinks that cause negligence. But is there any other sacrifice that has fewer requirements and undertakings, yet is more fruitful and beneficial? There is, Brahmin. It's when a realized one arises in the world, perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He has realized with his own insight this world, with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans, and he makes it known to others. He teaches Dhamma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, meaningful and well phrased, and he reveals a spiritual practice that's entirely full and pure. A householder hears that teaching, or a householder's child, or someone reborn in some clan. They gain faith in the realized one and reflect, living in a house is cramped and dirty, but the life of one gone forth is wide open. It's not easy for someone living at home to lead the spiritual life utterly full and pure, like a polished shell. Why don't I shave off my hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness? After some time they give up a large or small fortune and a large or small family circle. They shave off hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness. Once they've gone forth, they live restrained in the monastic code, conducting themselves well and seeking alms in suitable places. Seeing danger in the slightest fault, they keep the rules they've undertaken. They act skilfully by body and speech. They're purified in livelihood and accomplished in ethical conduct. They guard the sense doors, have mindfulness and situational awareness, and are content. And how is a mendicant accomplished in ethics? It's when a mendicant gives up killing living creatures, renouncing the rod and the sword. They're scrupulous and kind, living full of compassion for all living beings. This pertains to their ethics. They give up stealing. They take only what's given and expect only what's given. They keep themselves clean by not thieving. This pertains to their ethics. They give up unchastity. They are celibate, set apart, avoiding the common practice of sex. This pertains to their ethics. They give up lying. They speak the truth and stick to the truth. They are honest and trustworthy and don't trick the world with their words. This pertains to their ethics. They give up divisive speech. They don't repeat in one place what they heard in another, so as to divide people against each other. Instead, they reconcile those who are divided, supporting unity, delighting in harmony, loving harmony, speaking words that promote harmony. This pertains to their ethics. They give up harsh speech. They speak in a way that's mellow, pleasing to the ear, lovely, going to the heart, polite, likeable and agreeable to the people. This pertains to their ethics. They give up talking nonsense. Their words are timely, true and meaningful, in line with the teaching and training. They say things at the right time which are valuable, reasonable, succinct and beneficial. This pertains to their ethics. They refrain from injuring plants and seeds. They eat in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and food at the wrong time. They avoid dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows. They refrain from beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, fragrance, and makeup. They avoid high and luxurious beds. They avoid receiving gold and money, raw grains, raw meat, women and girls, male and female bond servants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants, cows, horses and mares, and fields and land. They refrain from running errands and messages, buying and selling, falsifying weights, metals or measures, bribery, fraud, cheating and duplicity, mutilation, murder, abduction, banditry, plunder and violence. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in injuring plants and seeds. These include plants propagated from roots, stems, cuttings or joints, and those from regular seeds as the fifth. They refrain from such injury to plants and seeds. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in storing up goods for their own use. This includes such things as food, drink, clothes, vehicles, bedding, fragrance, and material possessions. They refrain from storing up such goods. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in seeing shows. This includes such things as dancing, singing, music, performances and storytelling, clapping, gongs and kettle drums, art exhibitions and acrobatic displays, battles of elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, goats, rams, chickens and quails, staff fights, boxing and wrestling, combat, roll calls of the armed forces, battle formations and regimental reviews. They refrain from such shows. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in gambling that causes negligence. This includes such things as checkers, draughts, checkers in the air, hopscotch, spillikins, board games, tipcat, drawing straws, dice, leaf flutes, toy ploughs, somersaults, pinwheels, toy measures, toy carts, toy bows, guessing words from syllables, and guessing another's thoughts. They refrain from such gambling. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still make use of high and luxurious bedding. This includes such things as sofas, couches, woolen covers, shag-piled, colourful, white, embroidered with flowers, quilted, embroidered with animals, double or single-fringed, and silk covers studded with gems, as well as silken sheets, woven carpets, rugs for elephants, horses or chariots, antelope hide rugs, and spreads of fine deer hide with a canopy above and red cushions at both ends. They refrain from such bedding. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, fragrance, and makeup. This includes such things as applying beauty products by anointing, massaging, bathing, and rubbing, mirrors, ointments, garlands, fragrances, and makeup, face powder, foundation, bracelets, headbands, fancy walking sticks or containers, rapiers, parasols, fancy sandals, turbans, jewellery, chowries, and long-fringed white robes. They refrain from such beautification and adornment. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in unworthy talk. This includes such topics as talk about kings, bandits, and ministers, talk about armies, threats, and wars, talk about food, drink, clothes, and beds, talk about garlands and fragrances, talk about family, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries, talk about women and heroes, street talk and well talk, talk about the departed, motley talk, tales of land and sea, and talk about being reborn in this or that state of existence. They refrain from such unworthy talk. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in arguments. They say such things as, "You don't understand this teaching and training. I understand this teaching and training. What you understand this teaching and training? You're practicing wrong. I'm practicing right. I stay on topic, you don't. You said last what you should have said first. You said first what you should have said last. What you thought so much about has been disproved. Your doctrine is refuted. Go on, save your doctrine. You're trapped. Get yourself out of this if you can." They refrain from such argumentative talk. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in running errands and messages. This includes running errands for rulers, ministers, aristocrats, Brahmins, householders, or princes who say, "Go here, go there, take this, bring that from there." They refrain from such errands. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in deceit, flattery, hinting, and belittling, and using material possessions to pursue other material possessions. They refrain from such deceit and flattery. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes such fields as limb-reading, omenology, divining celestial portents, interpreting dreams, divining bodily marks, divining holes in cloth gnawed by mice, fire offerings, ladle offerings, offerings of husks, rice powder, rice, ghee, or oil, offerings from the mouth, blood sacrifices, palmistry, geomancy for building sites, fields and cemeteries, exorcisms, earth magic, snake charming, poisons, the crafts of the scorpion, the rat, the bird, and the crow, prophesying lifespan, chanting for protection, and animal cries. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes reading the marks of gems, cloth, clubs, swords, spears, arrows, weapons, women, men, boys, girls, male and female bondservants, elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, cows, goats, rams, chickens, quails, monitor lizards, rabbits, tortoises, or deer. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes making predictions that the king will march forth or march back, or that our king will attack and the enemy king will retreat, or vice versa, or that our king will triumph and the enemy king will be defeated, or vice versa. And so there will be victory for one and defeat for the other. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes making predictions that there will be an eclipse of the moon, or sun, or stars, that the sun, moon, and stars will be in conjunction or in opposition, that there will be a meteor shower, a fiery sky, an earthquake, thunder, that there will be a rising, a setting, a darkening, a brightening of the moon, sun, and stars. And it also includes making predictions about the results of all such phenomena. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes predicting whether there will be plenty of rain or drought, plenty to eat or famine, an abundant harvest or a bad harvest, security or peril, sickness or health. It also includes such occupations as computing, accounting, calculating, poetry, and cosmology. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes making arrangements for giving and taking in marriage, for engagement and divorce, and for scattering rice inwards or outwards at the wedding ceremony. It also includes casting spells for good or bad luck, curses to prevent conception, bind the tongue or lock the jaws, charms for the hands and ears, questioning a mirror, a girl, or a god as an oracle, worshipping the sun, worshipping the Great One, breathing fire, and invoking Siri, the goddess of luck. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes rites for propitiation, for granting wishes, for ghosts, for the earth, for rain, for property settlement, and for preparing and consecrating house sites, and rites involving rinsing and bathing, and oblations. It also includes administering emetics, purgatives, expectorants, and phlemagogues, administering ear oils, eye restoratives, nasal medicine, ointments, and counter-ointments, surgery with needle and scalpel, treating children, prescribing root medicines, and binding on herbs. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. A mendicant thus accomplished in ethics sees no danger in any quarter in regards to their ethical restraint. It's like a king who has defeated his enemies. He sees no danger from his foes in any quarter. In the same way, a mendicant thus accomplished in ethics sees no danger in any quarter in regards to their ethical restraint. When they have this entire spectrum of noble ethics, they experience a blameless happiness inside themselves. That's how a mendicant is accomplished in ethics. And how does a mendicant guard the sense doors? When a noble disciple sees a sight with their eyes, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. When they hear a sound with their ears, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of hearing were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of hearing and achieving its restraint. When they smell an odour with their nose, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of smell were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of smell and achieving its restraint. When they taste a flavour with their tongue, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of taste were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of taste and achieving its restraint. When they feel a touch with their body, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of touch were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of touch and achieving its restraint. When they know a thought with their mind, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of mind were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of mind and achieving its restraint. When they have this noble sense restraint, they experience an unsullied bliss inside themselves. That's how a mendicant guards the sense doors. And how does a mendicant have mindfulness and situational awareness? It's when a mendicant acts with situational awareness, when going out and coming back, when looking ahead and aside, when bending and extending the limbs, when bearing the outer robe, bowl and robes, when eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, waking, speaking and keeping silent. That's how a mendicant has mindfulness and situational awareness. And how is a mendicant content? It's when a mendicant is content with robes to look after the body and alms food to look after the belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only these things. They're like a bird. Wherever it flies, wings are its only burden. In the same way, a mendicant is content with robes to look after the body and alms food to look after the belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only these things. That's how a mendicant is content. When they have this noble spectrum of ethics, this noble sense restraint, this noble mindfulness and situational awareness, and this noble contentment, they frequent a secluded lodging, a wilderness, the root of a tree, a hill, a ravine, a mountain cave, a charnel ground, a forest, the open air, a heap of straw. After the meal, They return from arms round, sit down cross-legged with their body straight, and establish mindfulness right there. Giving up desire for the world, they meditate with the heart rid of desire, cleansing the mind of desire. Giving up ill will and malevolence, they meditate with a mind rid of ill will, full of compassion for all living beings, cleansing the mind of ill will. Giving up dullness and drowsiness, they meditate with a mind rid of dullness and drowsiness, perceiving light, mindful and aware, cleansing the mind of dullness and drowsiness. Giving up restlessness and remorse, they meditate without restlessness, their mind peaceful inside, cleansing the mind of restlessness and remorse. Giving up doubt, they meditate having gone beyond doubt, not undecided about skillful qualities, cleansing the mind of doubt. Suppose a man who has gotten into debt were to apply himself to work and his efforts proved successful. He would pay off the original loan and have enough left over to support his partner. Thinking about this, he'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose there was a person who was sick, suffering, gravely ill. They'd lose their appetite and get physically weak. But after some time, they'd recover from that illness and regain their appetite and their strength. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose a person was imprisoned in a jail. But after some time, they were released from jail, safe and sound, with no loss of wealth. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose a person was a bond servant. They belonged to someone else and were unable to go where they wish. But after some time they'd be freed from servitude and become their own master, an emancipated individual able to go where they wish. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose there was a person with wealth and property who was travelling along a desert road which was perilous, with nothing to eat. But after some time they crossed over the desert safely, reaching the neighbourhood of a village, a sanctuary free of peril. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. In the same way, as long as these five hindrances are not given up inside themselves, a mendicant regards them thus as a debt, a disease, a prison, slavery, and a desert crossing. But when these five hindrances are given up inside themselves, a mendicant regards this as freedom from debt, good health, release from prison, emancipation, and sanctuary. Seeing that the hindrances have been given up in them, joy springs up. Being joyful, rapture springs up. When the mind is full of rapture, the body becomes tranquil. When the body is tranquil, they feel bliss. And when blissful, the mind becomes immersed. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, they enter and remain in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. They drench, steep, fill and spread their body with rapture and bliss born of seclusion. There's no part of the body that's not spread with rapture and bliss born of seclusion. It's like when a deft bathroom attendant or their apprentice pours bath powder into a bronze dish, sprinkling it little by little with water. They knead it until the ball of bath powder is soaked and saturated with moisture, spread through inside and out, yet no moisture oozes out. In the same way, a mendicant drenches, steeps, fills, and spreads their body with rapture and bliss born of seclusion. There's no part of the body that's not spread with rapture and bliss born of seclusion. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. Furthermore, as the placing of the mind and keeping it connected are stilled, a mendicant enters and remains in the second absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of immersion, with internal clarity and confidence and unified mind, without applying the mind and keeping it connected. In the same way, a mendicant drenches, steeps, fills, and spreads their body with rapture and bliss born of immersion. There's no part of the body that's not spread with rapture and bliss born of immersion. It's like a deep lake fed by spring water. There's no inlet to the east, west, north, or south, and no rainfall to replenish it from time to time. But the stream of cool water welling up in the lake drenches, steeps, fills, and spreads throughout the lake. There's no part of the lake that's not spread through with cool water. In the same way, a mendicant drenches, steeps, fills, and spreads their body with rapture and bliss born of immersion. There's no part of the body that's not spread with rapture and bliss born of immersion. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. Furthermore, with the fading away of rapture, a mendicant enters and remains in the third absorption, where they meditate with equanimity, mindful and aware, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare, "Equanimous and mindful, one meditates in bliss." They drench, steep, fill, and spread their body with bliss free of rapture. There's no part of the body that's not spread with bliss free of rapture. It's like a pool with blue water lilies or pink or white lotuses. Some of them sprout and grow in the water without rising above it, thriving underwater. From the tip to the root they're drenched, steeped, filled, and soaked with cool water. There's no part of them that's not soaked with cool water. In the same way, a mendicant drenches, steeps, fills, and spreads their body with bliss free of rapture. There's no part of the body that's not spread with bliss free of rapture. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. Furthermore, giving up pleasure and pain, and ending former happiness and sadness, a mendicant enters and remains in the fourth absorption, without pleasure or pain, with pure equanimity and mindfulness. It's like someone sitting wrapped from head to foot with white cloth. There's no part of the body that's not spread over with white cloth. In the same way, they sit spreading their body through with pure, bright mind. There's no part of the body that's not spread with pure, bright mind. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge and vision. They understand, this body of mine is physical. It's made up of the four primary elements produced by mother and father, built up from rice and porridge, liable to impermanence, to wearing away and erosion, to breaking up and destruction. And this consciousness of mine is attached to it, tied to it. Suppose there was a beryl gem that was naturally beautiful, eight-faceted, well-worked, transparent, clear and unclouded, endowed with all good qualities. And it was strung with a thread of blue, yellow, red, white or golden brown. And someone with good eyesight were to take it in their hand and check it. This beryl gem is naturally beautiful, eight-faceted, well-worked, transparent, clear and unclouded, endowed with all good qualities, and it's strung with a thread of blue, yellow, red, white, or golden brown. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge and vision. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward the creation of a mind-made body. From this body they create another body, physical, mind-made, complete in all its various parts, not deficient in any faculty. Suppose a person was to draw a reed out from its sheath. They'd think, this is the reed, this is the sheath. The reed and the sheath are different things. The reed has been drawn out from the sheath. Or suppose a person was to draw a sword out from its scabbard. They'd think, this is the sword, this is the scabbard. The sword and the scabbard are different things. The sword has been drawn out from the scabbard. Or suppose a person was to draw a snake out from its slough. They'd think, this is the snake, this is the slough. The snake and the slough are different things. The snake has been drawn out from the slough. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward the creation of a mind-made body. From this body they create another body, physical, mind-made, complete in all its various parts, not deficient in any faculty. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward psychic power. They wield the many kinds of psychic power, multiplying themselves and becoming one again, going unimpeded through a wall, a rampart, or a mountain as if through space, diving in and out of the earth as if it were water, walking on water as if it were earth, flying cross-legged through the sky like a bird, touching and stroking with the hand the sun and moon, so mighty and powerful, controlling the body as far as the Brahma realm. Suppose an expert potter or their apprentice had some well-prepared clay. They could produce any kind of pot that they like. Or suppose a deft ivory carver or their apprentice had some well-prepared ivory. They could produce any kind of ivory item that they like. Or suppose a deft goldsmith or their apprentice had some well-prepared gold. They could produce any kind of gold item that they like. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward psychic power. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward clairaudience. With clairaudience that is purified and superhuman, they hear both kinds of sounds, human and divine, whether near or far. Suppose there was a person travelling along the road. They'd hear the sound of drums, clay drums, horns, kettle drums, and tom-toms. They'd think, that's the sound of drums, and that's the sound of clay drums, and that's the sound of horns, kettle drums, and tom-toms. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward clairaudience. With clairaudience that is purified and superhuman, they hear both kinds of sounds, human and divine, whether near or far. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward comprehending the minds of others. They understand the minds of other beings and individuals, having comprehended them with their own mind. They understand mind with greed as mind with greed, and mind without greed as mind without greed. They understand mind with hate as mind with hate, and mind without hate as mind without hate. They understand mind with delusion as mind with delusion, and mind without delusion as mind without delusion. They understand constricted mind as constricted mind, and scattered mind as scattered mind. They understand expansive mind as expansive mind, and unexpansive mind as unexpansive mind. They understand mind that is not supreme as mind that is not supreme, and mind that is supreme as mind that is supreme. They understand immersed mind as immersed mind, and unimmersed mind as unimmersed mind. They understand freed mind as freed mind, and unfreed mind as unfreed mind. Suppose there was a woman or man who was young, youthful, and fond of adornments, and they check their own reflection in a clean, bright mirror or a clear bowl of water. If they had a spot, they'd know, I have a spot. And if they had no spots, they'd know, I have no spots. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward comprehending the minds of others. They understand the minds of other beings and individuals, having comprehended them with their own mind. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward recollection of past lives. They recollect many kinds of past lives, that is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000 rebirths, many eons of the world contracting, many eons of the world expanding, many eons of the world contracting and expanding. They remember, there I was named this, my clan was that, I looked like this, and that was my food. This was how I felt pleasure and pain, and that was how my life ended. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn somewhere else. There too I was named this, my clan was that, I looked like this, and that was my food. This was how I felt pleasure and pain, and that was how my life ended. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn here. And so they recollect their many kinds of past lives with features and details. Suppose a person was to leave their home village and go to another village. From that village they'd go to yet another village, and from that village they'd return to their home village. They'd think, I went from my home village to another village. There I stood like this, sat like that, spoke like this, or kept silent like that. From that village I went to yet another village. There too I stood like this, sat like that, spoke like this, or kept silent like that. And from that village I returned to my home village. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward recollection of past lives. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge of the death and rebirth of sentient beings. With clairvoyance that is purified and superhuman, they see sentient beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, in a good place or a bad place. They understand how sentient beings are reborn according to their deeds. These dear beings did bad things by way of body, speech, and mind. They spoke ill of the noble ones, they had wrong view, and they acted out of that wrong view. When their body breaks up after death, they're reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, hell. These dear beings, however, did good things by way of body, speech, and mind. They never spoke ill of the noble ones. They had right view, and they acted out of that right view. When their body breaks up after death, they're reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. And so, with clairvoyance that is purified and superhuman, they see sentient beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, in a good place or a bad place. They understand how sentient beings are reborn according to their deeds. Suppose there was a stilt longhouse at the central square. A person with good eyesight standing there might see people entering and leaving a house, walking along the streets and paths, and sitting at the central square. They'd think, these are people entering and leaving a house, walking along the streets and paths, and sitting at the central square. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge of the death and rebirth of sentient beings. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge of the ending of defilements. They truly understand this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. They truly understand these are defilements, this is the origin of defilements, this is the cessation of defilements, this is the practice that leads to the cessation of defilements. Knowing and seeing like this, their mind is freed from the defilements of sensuality, desire to be reborn, and ignorance. When they're freed, they know they're freed. They understand rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done, there is no return to any state of existence. This sacrifice has fewer requirements and undertakings than the former, yet is more fruitful and beneficial. And, Brahmin, there is no other accomplishment of sacrifice which is better and finer than this. When he had spoken, Kutatanta said to the Buddha, "Excellent, Master Gotama, excellent," as if he were writing the overturned, or revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark so people with good eyes can see what's there. Master Gotama has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to Master Gotama, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. And these bulls, bullocks, heifers, goats, and rams, 700 of each, I release them. I grant them life. Let them eat green grass and drink cool water, and may a cool breeze blow upon them. Then the Buddha taught Kutatanta step by step with a talk on giving, ethical conduct and heaven. He explained the drawbacks of sensual pleasures, so sordid and corrupt, and the benefit of renunciation. And when he knew that Kutatanta's mind was ready, pliable, rid of hindrances, joyful and confident, he explained the special teaching of the Buddhas. Suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. Just as a clean cloth rid of stains would properly absorb dye, in that very seat the stainless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in the Brahmin Kutatanta. Everything that has a beginning has an end. Then Kutatanta saw, attained, understood, and fathomed the Dhamma. He went beyond doubt, got rid of indecision, and became self-assured and independent of others regarding the teacher's instructions. He said to the Buddha, "Would Master Gotama, together with the mendicant Sangha, please accept tomorrow's meal from me?" The Buddha consented in silence. Then, Knowing that the Buddha had consented, Kutadanta got up from his seat, bowed and respectfully circled the Buddha, keeping him on his right before leaving. And when the night had passed, Kutadanta had a variety of delicious foods prepared in his own home. Then he had the Buddha informed of the time, saying, "It's time, Master Gotama. The meal is ready." Then the Buddha robed up in the morning and, taking his bowl and robe, went to the home of Kutadanta together with the mendicant Sangha, where he sat on the seat spread out. Then Kutadanta served and satisfied the mendicant Sangha, headed by the Buddha with his own hands, with a variety of delicious foods. When the Buddha had eaten and washed his hand and bowl, Kutadanta took a low seat and sat to one side. Then the Buddha educated, encouraged, fired up and inspired him with a Dhamma talk, after which he got up from his seat and left.